This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. It's been 300 years since Blackbeard's ship, Queen Anne's Revenge, sank to the bottom of the ocean. But the infamous pirate continues to capture our attention.
Mutiny. And what fate befalls mutineers? Now, we know the answer to that, do we not? Mutineers.
There he is in the 2011 Disney film Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. So while the mythology around Blackbeard looms large in popular culture, less is known about his flagship vessel. Queen Anne's Revenge came to its demise right off the coast of North Carolina, and for more than 20 years, archaeologists have been digging through the sand to uncover relics from the ship. A new book takes a comprehensive look at that search. It's called Blackbeard's Sunken Prize, The 300-Year Voyage of Queen Anne's Revenge. Joining me now are the book's authors. Mark Wild Ramsing is the former Deputy State Underwater Archaeologist of North Carolina and the former director of the Recovery Project. Mark, hello.
Hello, Anita.
And Linda Carnes-McNaughton is the program archaeologist and curator at Fort Bragg's Cultural Resources Management Program and a longtime volunteer on the ship excavation project. Linda, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So as someone who didn't grow up in North Carolina, I have to admit that much of what I knew about Blackbeard before reading this book did come from popular culture. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, Blackbeard and pirate are sort of synonymous. And I feel like your book is really trying to pick apart what made Blackbeard Blackbeard. So tell us about what made Blackbeard so distinct.
Well, I think you hit the tree nail on the head there. The shipwreck is a shipwreck, pirate shipwreck, and it's Blackbeard's shipwreck. He has come about in fame through folklore and historical accounts. But what the excavations and what the analysis of the artifacts, what we're able to take a closer look at is the types of behaviors or the types of things that sort of redefine who he was, maybe give us a different perspective of who he was from the material remains.
And you talk in the book about his particular brand of pirating. So he wasn't a hit-and-run pirate. He had a very different style. Tell me about his style and how you were able to uncover that through this work.
Well, we know from historical records, which augment all of the work that we do, that he was a trained in the Royal Navy, so he was a full-fledged captain. He understood mathematics. He was educated. He was a strategist, and he was a businessman. So all of those things are important to getting a fuller picture of who he was and how he was successful in his brief career as a pirate, which was basically only 18 months, that he achieved so much in such a short period of time. So we're kind of unteasing that and trying to look at it in an analytical way from the material of the shipwreck.
And tell me about, Mark, maybe how he ended up in North Carolina.
Well, he had blockaded Charleston. That was his biggest feat, I guess, or, against the royal, the colonies. And I think he knew North Carolina was sort of a backward colony, had a weak government. They'd been sort of devastated by Native American wars with the Tuscarora. He also had with him a colleague, Stede Bonnet, who had spent time here in North Carolina. So between all of that, he probably saw that this was a good hideout. And I think eventually he ended up in Ocracoke, and it was in that area where he could attack the ships that were going up and down the coast and sort of be left alone. So I think North Carolina was one of the last bastions at that point as the British were really narrowing down and trying to stamp out piracy.
And so we've been talking about Queen Anne's Revenge, but the name of the ship was not always Queen Anne's Revenge. Tell me about the history of the ship before Blackbeard got it and how he came to get the ship.
Well, the ship, we don't know exactly where it was built. There's a number of things that are of still mysteries for us, and that's one. But it appears in 1710 as a French privateer, was in the Queen Anne's War. It was actually fighting the English and Spanish with the Spanish. Privateering was sort of a way to disrupt in shipping and not have to hire a navy, just pay these people to disrupt things. So it operated for a couple of years that way, and then it sort of drops out. But at the end of Queen Anne's War in 1713, it became immediately was put into service as a slave ship, and it made three voyages very similar to the privateering voyage that went down to Africa, then over to the Caribbean, and then back to Europe. And on the third voyage, they were getting close to Martinique, and that's when they met pirates, Bonnet and Steed Bonnet and Blackbeard and the other vessel, and they were suffering from a lot of casualties, sickness, and so they were pretty easy marks. And Blackbeard took it easily and decided that he would keep that armed large vessel for his flagship.
And it was his flagship. He had up to four vessels. At one point, he had between 300 or 400 people working under him. It was really an incredible crew that he had. They were incredibly well-armed that you all sort of documented. So I want to hear a little bit about how you came to uncover all of these artifacts that have given us such a sense of life on that ship. We called you an underwater archaeologist. It conjures a lot of wonderful images for me, but tell me what it's like to be under the water and how you all came across Queen Anne's Revenge.
Well, this site that is about a mile offshore in very nice waters is a little bit unusual for me. I began my diving in Winston-Salem at the YMCA, and our open water dive was a quarry, a dark, cold quarry. And then as an underwater archaeologist in the state, we did all our diving in really mucky rivers and just wasn't the most pleasant. When we started diving, the first few dives on Queen Anne's Revenge weren't the best. It's not always beautiful, but in October of 1997, we geared up, and what you do as a diver would put on your wetsuit, which is pretty restrictive, put on a 20-pound tank, put a lot of weight on because we like to be heavy when we're down on the bottom working and not moving around. And so you're really cumbersome getting off the deck. It's sort of like a penguin trying to get to the water, and then you've seen these films where as soon as they get there, boom, you're in a wonderful environment, buoyant, and you can go slowly down. You go through, I was going through these schools of fish, angelfish swimming all about. It was crystal clear water. You could see this room-sized mound of anchors and cannon. Once you got down, it seems to be quiet, and then all of a sudden you hear this crunching of the sheephead fish that are eating the barnacles and munching away, especially as you work and uncover things, they would be in there. Other fish, sea bass, are right at your face looking at you.
And I love that. So you have these pals down there who are alongside you,
wonderful.
Helping you excavate.
You're concentrating, and then all of a sudden there's a little fish in your mouth. So it's been a real pleasure to work on that site particularly.
And so as you all try to paint a picture for people listening about sort of what it's like to map out the site and how you all began to actually find these artifacts.
It's a lot like a detective entering a crime scene. What we did was tag the larger things that we could tell, which was these three large anchors and several cannons. And those also were sticking up above the seabed, so they gave us reference. And from there, we laid out grids, 5 by 5 foot squares, and we have about 750 squares across this area that we think most of the debris field is. There's no shipwreck there, but there's a lot of artifacts scattered, and we basically slowly excavate each unit. And once we get things uncovered, we tag them, map them in, and then carefully bring them to the surface, and then off to the lab they go for conservation and analysis.
Okay, and that's sort of where they transition into Linda's care a bit more.
Sure.
So tell me a bit about sort of the breadth of artifacts that you all have been able to uncover so far.
Yeah, sure, Anita. So between what Mark's job is bringing the artifacts up off the ocean floor, to, under my microscope doing analysis, there's this entire conservation process that has to happen. And that's a team of people working at the QAR lab near East Carolina University.
Queen Anne's Revenge Lab.
And that's a very, very slow process. It's a very tedious process. It's books are written on conservation processes. But to break it down into three categories for people who are interested, there's the post-recovery process, so where it comes up off the ocean floor. First, it goes into tanks because you can't allow these artifacts to dry out quickly because they're coming out of a saltwater environment. So it's very important to keep them damp and moist and covered. And the process of desalination is a very lengthy thing. Some artifacts take up to 5 years, depending on what their composition is. So all of that goes back to the laboratory and takes place in the laboratory. Electrolysis takes place. There are some artifacts that come up as single artifacts, like cannon, anchors, even wine bottles, intact wine bottles, pewter plates. So some things come up whole, and they simply require cleaning and desalination. Some require breaking down those concretions, which is sort of excavation in the lab. And once all of this process is done, then the artifact is identified as to what it is. It's given an artifact number. It's photographed. And then the treatment actually begins, depending on what it's made of. So different types of treatment. Electrolysis is one of them that they use. We've also recovered wood. We've covered fabric from sailcloth. We've recovered keratin from a lantern that was made out of horn. So a variety, rope is another one. So a variety of organic things that don't normally survive have made it into the lab. And finally, the last part of it is recording and documentation. And that's sort of where I come in because I'm not an underwater diver. I like to keep my head above water. So I come in to the lab, and again, as a volunteer on my days off from Fort Bragg. And most of the time, the things are in a condition that's stable so that even with gloved hands, you're allowed to handle it. And that's where the nitty-gritty gets going. You know, you measure it. You look at it under a microscope if it's small. You look for maker's marks, manufacturing marks. You look for artifacts that can be cross-mended, for example, in the ceramics. So anything that is identifiable about the artifact that can tell us the period it was made, who made it, the country of origin, manufacturing, perhaps if it was modified or recycled, and, of course, dating. All of those things are important for an archaeological site, is to get a preponderance of artifacts that can be dated.
So would you argue that with the evidence that you all have so far, you feel confident in saying that this is, in fact, Queen Anne's Revenge?
Yes, I think we would agree 100%.
Okay.
Yes, it's the right kind of ship. It's the right date, the right place, the right characteristics. In a little sleepy town, as always, Beaufort's always been pretty sleepy, so we're confident. And in 2012, we wrote a journal article that summed up all this circumstantial evidence, and we called it Beyond Reasonable Doubt, was written with Dr. Ewan at East Carolina, and I think it was very compelling, and we haven't heard anything about it not being Queen Anne's Revenge since.
So some of the artifacts that you all found confirm some of the pirate myths, I would say, that there was a ton of alcohol, that alcohol was one of the most common things that they would steal from other ships. But others sort of refute, especially some of the myths around Blackbeard. So there has been this longstanding idea that he was a pretty egalitarian guy. He did, in fact, share his wealth with everyone. But the layout of the ship and the layout of the artifacts has proven to you all that that's not quite the case, that there was a pretty strong hierarchy on the ship. Is that right?
Well, yes, I think that if you map it out, I think most of what would be considered valuables would be found in the stern area, which was near the captain's quarters. So he had some watch over everything that was going on. And I think that also, you know, we did, representing pirate culture of what you were talking about, that the things that we found are small, tiny pieces of gold jewelry that have been snipped, clipped, if you will, so that they that readies them for distribution. So we're finding things that are clearly pirate culture. The rum that you mentioned, we know from historical records that was stolen off of other ships. And, you know, there was some lamenting if the rum stock was getting low. But we have a cask. We have a keg tap. We have stoneware jugs. We have other kinds of containers that represent. There was a lot of liquid diet going on.
And the medical equipment that you all were able to find is really fascinating. Tell me about some of the highlights from that.
Yes, thanks, Anita. Yeah, that's been a very intriguing aspect. When you begin analysis of the artifacts, you begin to look at them as how they functioned on the ship. What are elements of the ship? What are clothing items? What are related to food and drink? And then we begin to find these medical equipment objects. And the majority of them do have French manufacturing marks on them. So again, augmenting our research with the known historical records, we know that Blackbeard kidnapped the chief surgeon and his two aides when he stole the French ship. So it ends up, the research sort of proves this out, that the Vademecum, which is your daily booklet of how to do things, indicates that there was a contract agreement between the surgeon, the ship owner, and the captain. So while the medical equipment would belong to the ship surgeons, who would be treating everything from constipation to a bullet hole, these medical pieces were used and owned by the surgeons, but the expendables, for example, the mercury that was used to treat syphilis, would have to be then restocked, if you will, in the medicine chest. And that was the responsibility of the captain. That was a eureka moment for us.
And Mark, I know that you and some others had a eureka moment around something related to Blackbeard's toilet. May I ask about that?
Yes, that was a good one. It was a fairly large tube, a lead tube that was sort of squished up when we found it. A lot of speculation. It looked like it might be a scupper, some way to a tube to take the water off the deck, or a funnel. But eventually we identified it as a pistale, which is the lead liner for the toilet in the captain's cabin. And indeed, it would do the same thing. It would be a little balcony off the side of the vessel that would take the waste out. And so a lot of fun with that one, because the toilet facilities on a ship were called the head. So we were debating whether we should say we had found Blackbeard's head. It's about as close as you want to get to Blackbeard, I would think.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to get any closer after reading this book. So I only have about 30 seconds left, but I felt like a lot of this book was sort of you all laying bare the fact that the media attention and this huge pop culture phenomenon around Blackbeard has put significant pressure on you all as archaeologists and on the find. How do you feel about where things stand now in terms of that pressure and what you've been able to uncover, and where you think the legacy of the project will lie going forward?
Well, one thing that I think that we can emphasize is that as we study the artifacts, we are looking at more than just the pirates on board this ship. We're looking at the enslaved cargo of Africans that were on this ship, and we're looking at the kidnapped French crewmen on this ship. So that's very democratic. That gives us information about all these three groups of people. And just a reminder that it's only 60% excavated. So the work will continue for years to come.
And we're extremely proud of this book, and UNC Press has done a wonderful job to help us tell a story, a lot of photographs, and it's a story that is well worth reading.
Wonderful. Mark Wild Ramsing is the former Deputy State Underwater Archaeologist of North Carolina and the former director of the Queen Anne's Revenge Shipwreck Project. Linda Carnes McNaughton is the program archaeologist and curator at Fort Bragg's Cultural Resources Management Program. And their new book is called Blackbeard's Sunken Prize, The 300-Year Voyage of Queen Anne's Revenge. You can catch them both at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh this Sunday at 2 p.m. Find out all information at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anita.
Just ahead, Gracie Curran and the Highfalutin Band.